societies, both pleased and proud to present this evening's distinguished speaker, President John T. Kessinger III, for a speech entitled "Constancy, Change in a New University." John Kessinger has served as president of the University of Virginia since August of 1990. During Mr. Kessinger's presidency, the university has been recognized for its leadership in educating minority students, for the quality of its undergraduate teaching and faculty research, and for its success in refinancing itself and restructuring its relationship with the state following historic reductions in state taxes. Mr. Kessinger was designated as the Outstanding Virginian in 1993. He was awarded the Gold Medal of the National Institute of Social Sciences in 1998 and the Virginia AIA's Architecture Medal for Virginia Service in 2004. He was inducted as a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in October 2009. Mr. Kessinger is active in government, business, and all the national organizations that represent academic interests. Mr. Kessinger will step down in August of 2010 after serving as the university's president for 20 years. Please join me in welcoming President Kessinger.
Semester as a way of wrapping up my work and hopefully preparing for the work that President Selma will begin in the summer. It's not working that way because of the travel schedule that I've had to maintain to keep the capital funds campaign moving. So this is really cuttings. I have used some pieces of the material in other places. For example, in an article that you will, if you see it, you'll recognize it being similar to some of these notes that will be in the University of Virginia magazine in the upcoming issue. And there are some other pieces that you will have heard elsewhere. Three topics that I wanted to cover are, first of all, the, I guess, historical irony that we have grown very slowly on what you might think of as the two perimeters of the curriculum, to find the performing arts on one side and the pure sciences on the other side. The humanities, the social sciences, the professional schools, and so on, in the middle of what we might imagine is the range of disciplines on a kind of spectrum within the university. The irony is simply that we seem to be so good, or to have been so good historically, in certain fields that were obviously essential to the practice of certain professions, such as the law or medicine, which professions were our natural backyard in prior times, and so slow to develop in other fields that are essential to how we are defined as a people, as an economy, and obviously how we progress toward a future that will inevitably not be the same as present time. The second is an issue that's a bit more philosophical, but it has to do about the phenomenon that universities in general pride themselves on their adherence to tradition, while in fact one could argue that their largest value to culture is in the area of innovation or change, and the fact that we do not commonly see the two purposes, sustaining a tradition, fomenting change, as being our problem, and yet they are very much at the core of what goes on intellectually and culturally within a university. And the third is simply a set of historical remarks about the transition that we are in the process of making from a university focused on regional or parochial concerns or issues to a university focused on much larger global issues. A set of changes that I suspect will not be news to anyone, but I think it is helpful from time to time to identify where the post holes are when you start describing what structure holds history up. So those are the topics. Let me start with an observation, or set of observations, about this irony of weakness on the ends of the spectrum that I was constructing. I mean, that first of all, that there is no such spectrum. It's simply that one needs a about the university's founder. He's said to have owned the finest art collection in America. The collection was not an art collection in the modern sense. It was a collection of typically prints. And his reasons for collecting were quite different from ours. If we were to collect, we would seek out probably the finest artists, the finest paintings, and so on. Jefferson saw art as having a purpose. It was one of the useful sciences that he tried to build into this curriculum. And the purpose of art, which he wrote about quite frequently, was to teach morality. So, for example, if you want to find the best collection of 18th and 19th century prints having to do with the abuse of women in the Old Testament of the Bible, the place to go was Monticello, because Jefferson collected those prints systematically and used them as a way of teaching moral lessons. By the way, he arranged the prints in the front room in Monticello, which he considered a gallery. He was said to be one of the best dancers in America, and he was also admired for his capacities as a dancer when he was in Paris. The quartet and sometimes trio that his daughters and he and one of the performers had at Monticello for performances at dinners, that was said to be the best musical group in America in his time, best performing group. Obviously one of the two great American architects of that period, although ironically there is a third, Judith Walker, whose masterpiece is hidden not 5 miles from here, who also deserves to be known in the way in which Jefferson and Bulfinch are known. He was a scientist. If you read Jefferson, one of the first things that leaps out at you is the detailed knowledge of such things as climate studied over a long period of time. That's not an accident. If you look at Jefferson's garden book or farm book, you will find that he and his daughter, while he was in Paris or in London and she was here, kept systematic records of temperature readings, weather observations, and so on, taken at identical times on what they considered the opposite sides of the globe, as he attempted to figure out whether there might be some larger weather system that would explain the variations of weather in one place or another. He was an astronomer. He had very carefully calculated ways to predict events that would be of practical value. Astronomy, like art, like graphic art, had a use in this world driven by the useful sciences that he intended to teach him. He's a paleontologist. We drive up and down Route 29 North all the time, past a subdivision called Carsbrook. If you look carefully, you will find the state historical marker that's rather battered right now, but it's one of those silver markers in black bridges that the state sticks along its highways. It describes a man named Dabney Carr and his home, which was in Carsbrook. Near Dabney Carr's home, if you drive back and find it, don't climb across the fence and get yourself in trouble with the landlord. See the line from that house down through the Ravan River, which is below the house. There was, when Jefferson was a child, a very large Indian mound, a burial mound on that site. And he became very interested in what could be understood about American Indian culture, settlement, sociology, and so on in this region by excavating that site. So he began by studying techniques of excavation. And then, as a fairly young man, he carried out the excavation of the site. For better or worse, the excavation technologies of the time were very destructive. What he discovered is that many, many people had been buried in that mound. He speculated, as later scientists have pretty much proved, that the burials began on the lowest level in one time period, and then they were mounded up to create the mound, so that the mound was not constructed as a mound. The mound was a derivative of what we lay inside of it. The form of the mound followed its function, which was to bury the dead from the tribes that lived in this region. He was a physicist. He was very interested in the physics of motion, the physics of change. The fields that were eventually captured and purified in calculus were of constant interest to him. And if you study those gadgets that fill the front room at Monticello and try to figure out how such things might be made, realize that their exercises and the type of calculus that you use in carrying out experiments in physics. And then, because he was a farmer, a botanist, and studied his land, studied the kinds of things that were grown on it very carefully. It's worth knowing also that he was a passionate believer that European science had wrong on pragmatic grounds. His great enemy was a French botanist whose name was Buffon, and Jefferson engaged in a decade-long battle with Buffon, because Buffon argued that all things on this continent were derived from things on the European continent, but on this continent they were smaller, less healthy, less interesting from the point of view of an anatomist or something. He made the same argument, by the way, about Africa, and Buffon had those suspicions also about China. So he was about as arrogant a nationalist scientist as you can imagine. Jefferson's response, as I'm sure you know, was, among other things, to send Lewis and Clark to the West with instructions to find giant animals. There's a fascinating current book whose title is called Thomas Jefferson and the Giant Moose, or Mr. Jefferson and the Giant Moose. There's an exercise in intellectual history that's absolutely fascinating. It has to do with Jefferson's belief that he had already learned enough by studying his environment to know that Buffon was wrong. But the Buffon was making his speeches, his lectures, and then publishing his books. Buffon published the official national compendium of living things for the kings of France, something like 138 volumes. So Buffon got plenty of time to publish his view of things. Jefferson ordered his people, including Lewis and Clark, find a giant moose, and he was particularly interested in stories about a giant moose he'd never seen that was about the size of, say, a giraffe. He did, incidentally, eventually acquire a giant moose, but the giant moose turns out on examination to have been a composite of three different mooses, and therefore not exactly what Jefferson thought it was. He also pulled together his argument in a book called Notes on the State of Virginia, which is important both for what it shows about Jefferson's capacities as a scientific observer and for what it shows about the lenses or the filters through which he saw matters having to do with race, ethnicity, and so on. He was convinced, for example, that Amerindian rhetoric was equal to European classical rhetoric. And he used the example of an Indian chief named Logan, who in a trial in Philadelphia tried to get compensation because a group of soldiers had run amok and killed his family. Logan's address to the court is reproduced in the book as a masterpiece. On the other hand, he did not perceive the same kinds of rhetorical skill or intellectual mastery in what he knew of other races. And he speculated that maybe other races could not learn as rapidly or as extensively as would Caucasians. To his credit, he didn't say absolutely it could not happen, but on the other hand, he also failed to know enough about his neighbors, including his closest neighbors, if you think about it, to acknowledge their obvious intellectual and other statures. So you have a founder who talks a great deal in creating this place about useful science, demonstrates what he means by useful science by his mastery of all sorts of bodies of knowledge, and I haven't tried to cover the whole field. Also an extraordinary horseman, for example, at a time when that was considered to be something like dancing, sort of art form appropriate for a gentleman. But in any event, you have the irony of a founder who believed in mastering both the sciences and the fine performing arts because they were, first of all, useful, and second, they were the stuff of freedom. Remember that his purpose from start to finish, as he defined it, was to provide a basis for freedom in the hemisphere. He creates a university in which his curriculum contains what he believes will be ultimately a compendium of all useful knowledge. The 10 pavilions, all of us know in some form, whether loosely or exactly, the functions of the pavilions as homes for the different disciplines. In this place, engineering was first taught as an academic discipline. Medicine was first taught as an academic discipline. The study of agriculture was first taught as an academic discipline. This was an ag school, in fact. He used the construction of the university's grounds to demonstrate various theories or demonstrated systems of construction. Our modern explorations have not produced it, but we know that one of the alleys was paved with a substance that was proposed by a Scotsman named James McAdam, who was one of the founders of the Scottish Enlightenment. We know the material as macadam or tarmac or whatever. Jefferson describes the construction, he gives the workers information on how to make the road self-draining and so on. We can't find the road. It's very possible that at some point in the 19th century the road was thought to be a mistake and somebody chiseled it up on the 20th century. You can make plenty of mistakes in our own time. But whatever, we can't find the road even though we know it was built on the elements. I think the simple explanation for our failures in both areas is the university's missing the point about coeducation. Now, there are reasons why the university missed the point. Let me start with the point. Yale's drama school, the fine arts programs at Princeton, the development of laboratory science at Princeton, which was historically a fairly small men's school, that primarily taught theoretical and historical science rather than experimental science. The development of larger laboratories and of the fine arts programs at Harvard. What those have in common is that they're consequences of the process of coeducation that occurred in the late 60s. And the way in which they're consequences has to do with how it missed the point. Those schools, when they began to plan how to coeducate, saw the coming of women and the inevitable increasing in enrollment. It's helpful to register that American universities in the 60s were small by comparison to our major European competitors. But a university like the one in Florence or the one in Rome would have been 10 or 12 times the size of Harvard in the mid-60s. But in any event, these other institutions realized, incidentally, UNC also did, realized that with the end of single-sex education and the potential doubling of the enrollments of those institutions, there was an opportunity to expand the curriculum, to redefine what was taught. And from that came, for example, specialized programs in such fields as Asian studies in the middle of the curriculum. And then often the edges of the curriculum, except my metaphor of the spectrum for men, those institutions developed their fine and performing arts programs. They developed their more intensive laboratory programs and so on. And they went from being top American institutions to being top institutions in the world as they used the product of growth, that is revenue from tuition, to pay for the kinds of programs that European universities in many instances had. Let me back off from that analogy for just a second and make this observation. To my knowledge, there is no European university system in which the fine and performing arts are taught within the university. And with the exception of the UK, all European nations have separate national academies that do most of the scientific research that is done in those nations. So we are a kind of blended system in this country. We have the fine and performing arts within our universities, we have also conservatories, but even universities without conservatories, such as this one, have programs in the fine and performing arts. And obviously we have national academies, national laboratories, and so on, to support scientific research. But on balance, over time, the bulk of scientific research since World War II has been done within the universities. There are a lot of reasons. A very basic one is that after World War II, the realization that German science had very nearly beaten us in World War II led to an enormous federal impulse to put funding into the land-grant universities. Take what have been established as agricultural and mechanical universities and turn them into powerhouses for science. So you have the growth of the University of Michigan, of Wisconsin, of Illinois, as well as in California, the growth of the UC system following World War II. We, I think, approached coeducation with a number of misconceptions. I'm sure I've told some of you this story, but I was an assistant dean in the college, the year in which we finally resolved the cases that have been filed to determine most of the litigation was wrapped up in one suit that had been filed by some law school faculty members on behalf of two women who they sought to enroll here because they believed that they could overturn the state's separate education statute. They did. The case lasted something like 12 minutes in federal district court. But I remember as an assistant dean having been part of, first of all, a roundtable discussion with a psychotherapist they sent us to teach us how women differ from men. And they were especially concerned that we not overestimate the intellectual capacities of women. We sat through this very strange orientation in which we were encouraged to understand that we had to have a somewhat less demanding standard for women students than we would have for men students. And then it was decided that we also needed to prepare our students to understand this phenomenon. So the two women who were admitted began studying in the fall of 1969. And they came in knowing that they were getting this. They weren't absolutely alone. One was here with her husband. The other was here with her parents. Both were superbly prepared. But I remember going over to the first of those holiday inn dormitories. The older deans got the dormitories that they thought would last. I got the ones maybe wouldn't last. So I was sent over to the dorms with the two guinea pig students so that the men students in those dorms could sit in the living rooms or parlors of their suites and get a look at what women actually looked like close. So what you had was a group of everybody, I'm sure, turned out in khaki breeches, wearing a 4 or 5 day worn shirt with a necktie that probably had gravy or milk all over it and had for several months. One of the things that we used to try to do was wear blue denim shirts instead of blue cotton shirts. And the idea was to wear it until it started to fall apart and needed one another. The Army Navy store charged about $3 for it. So it was cheaper than getting it clean. In any event, these guys were there, I suspect, although I don't remember, dressed as they were supposed to be, awkward as all get out. Most of us thought we had seen women before. We had mothers, we had sisters, we had dates. We sort of figured we knew what it was all about. And then we had two people who were rocket science talking to this group of gang of boys about what they would experience the following year, and they didn't follow the script. They were supposed to explain about sensitivities and about how women are better in fields like music and literature, but men are clearly better in mathematics and science. And yet, the exemplars, the examples, are women who can clearly do everything. And it was one of the most intimidating experiences yet. Maybe not bad preparation for those men. Because as you know, when the first 200 women came in the fall of 1970, history was over in the blink of an eye. Because the women who came were competitive, they were intellectually tough, they came to succeed. We had had the custom when I was a student sitting as far back in the room as you could. The reason was that in the back of the room, you could read the Cavalry Daily, drink your coffee and smoke, and believe that the professors wouldn't see you. And so the professor would have sort of an open field in the front. And every so often you'd run into somebody who sat on the front row. That person was said to be sticking his neck out. That phrase is apparently an ancient phrase. It's actually Virginis Badenis' History of the University, which is a fascinating book because it's basically an explanation of why the university took so long to become a major university. He says that this lack of aspiration, lack of a sense of what competition does for intellectual performance, and lack of understanding of the fact that Anglo-Saxon boys in khaki breeches were not necessarily going to rule the world. Mr. Cadney, in a sense, taxonomized us and laid us out to the examiner in the history. No one ever read the history, but I think I may be the only person who's read all of it. There are copies in the library. If you can't find one, I have one in the office. I'll lend it if you bring it back. But anyway, it's an interesting combination of nostalgia and a critique of a culture that did not understand that change is the essence of universities, and that change involves constantly remixing the population, constantly opening up to new populations with new claims to make on the university. Our competitor to the south, North Carolina, began co-education a couple of years before we did. Began it with the intention of building a great fine arts program, because UNC was afraid of falling behind us at the time. I suspect they felt they were a bit ahead of us. But also with a need to build stronger lab sciences, because NC State, across the triangle in Raleigh, had a world-class science program. Duke had both the fine arts and the sciences. And as Duke co-educated, it simply expanded programs that it had for years. But UNC saw the point. Why did we not see the point? Why did we simply build larger enrollments in the discipline we already had? One reason is probably that we did not have the resources. The university has always been very thinly financed in comparison to its neighbors. We still are. For all of the appearances of affluence around here, the lawn and whatnot, this is not a particularly wealthy university. It's a place that spends less per student than something like 64 other universities, and is academically ahead in the same rankings of something like 52 of those universities because of the students and the faculty members who choose to come here. And if you look at the university's assets per faculty member, we fall into the same bracket in the range of 64th to 65th. And yet the academic assessments of the quality of faculty, but the faculty up in the range of 12th to 13th to 14th, depending on which rankings you're looking at. So probably did not have the money. There were other things, some of them very odd. We did not believe in big buildings. Serious science is big buildings. Have you been to New Haven, Connecticut in the last 10 years and looked around as you drive into the Yale campus? The scale of those buildings is a direct consequence of the programs that we do. The form of the building follows on the function, which is to support big science. We are a place that historically had buildings constructed on a small scale, and we didn't change that. 60s, early 70s. In fact, we're just changing it now. The two buildings under construction just on this side of the stadium. One lab building for the college, one lab building for the engineering school, and other major buildings built recently in the research parks, and a couple behind the hospital are examples of at least the scale that we need to be looking for. Chances are pretty good that if we had had the means and the brains to do it about 20 years ago, we should have built not 140 or 170,000 square foot buildings, the kind we're building now, but maybe a 400,000 square foot building. And maybe that 400,000 square foot building should have housed all of the empirical sciences until such time as they kicked the walls in and we had to expand in some way. Had we done that, hindsight always being perfect, we'd probably say that we would have been not simply the only public institution left in the top tier in the 90s, but probably one very near the top 25, instead of working in the range of 20th to 25th, as we have for a number of years. And there were other things, not just in the sciences, but in many parts of our faculty. We had an historic predisposition, a kind of mindset, in the direction of theory and history, to go to a totally different field of study. We are only now beginning to build our first performance facilities for music. And the irony of that is that the facility we're building was actually financed because of the marching band. So you have a series of sort of strange coincidences that begin to catch up with the need for a different kind of structure to carry out a different purpose for the university. In the sciences, we had what we thought was a major start with regard to biology, and in those days psychology was beginning to be accepted as a science, with Gilmer Holm. When I became president, I had two negative goals. One was to get rid of Gilmer Holm, and the other was to get rid of the University Holm. Both still work in their original locations. We built the John Paul Jones Arena to take the original functions out of the University Hall. We are still a ways from providing what biology and so functional needs of biology and psychology, even as early as the mid-60s. We had not at that time constructed what was later on the new chemistry building. Chemistry is in a building called Cobb Lab that's down by the hospital. And Cobb Lab was most noteworthy because every so often some poor graduate student had an experiment go up and burn up his dissertation. This happened twice when I was a student. There was a lot of enthusiasm in chemistry for getting out of that building. And ironically enough, the hospital took it. I thought when the chemistry moved out, it took care of the pandemic. But it's now considered a major resource for the School of Medicine. Then other buildings that might have had steel, the physics building built in 1954. Look at it sometime and wonder how a physics department that was good enough to attract the National Academy of Science endorsement that led to the placement of the Soros CPAP accelerator facility in Newport News, what is now the Jefferson National Laboratory. That's an outgrowth of our physics department. It was one physics scientist, a faculty member's eccentric conception of how one might build a high-power accelerator without having to cross the Italian, the Australian outback, as they're now doing to build the next generation facility. We didn't get the facility here because there was a site of competition for locations, but out of that small facility, with laboratories which were finally caught on fire in the early 90s, turned out to extend up into the attics and be wrapped around the furnaces and so on. That underscale facility was what we had for physics. Biology, when I was a student, was across the street in the building we tore down to make space for the Harrison Institute. Too small for scientific research. The labs were simply teaching laboratories. If you go through one science after another, it becomes very obvious that we were really late catching on to what was involved in empirical science as it became the standard of the world. Then there was another phenomenon that comes into play. If you separate out the fine and performing arts from it and look at the sciences, we have the anomaly that the early interest of our Department of Material Science, this is an interest that developed in the late 70s, in medical applications of such theoretical concepts in those days as nanoscale technologies, that peculiar realization that the answer to medical needs was often to be found in an engineering laboratory, gave us a configuration of strength in the sciences that, to my knowledge, is unique in this country. Caltech and MIT don't have medical schools. What we have instead is an accidental brain trust that arrived here in the late 70s. You probably know this story too, but in the late 70s, a group of dissident South African scientists felt that South Africa was simply not going to find its way out of apartheid, decided simply to give up and come to this country. They shopped American universities. They were doing work we'd never heard of. Ultimately, they settled in our engineering laboratories. Wilsdorf Hall is named for a husband and wife. There were two of them. The wife, Doris, is still here. If you want a great speaker, have Doris come and talk about what was on her mind. One of those people was a man named John Matthews. And here you probably know the story. John Matthews had a son named Dave Matthews, who spent the bulk of his early life tending bar and playing music. And he hooked up with a fiddler who was living over in Orangedale. And he and the fiddler came up with an entirely different conception of what popular music should be. There's a degree of sophistication in that, by the way, that I love. If you want to explain the sound of the fiddle band music, you've got to go to Ireland and go to bars. And this is what happens in Irish bars. Pubs. But in any event, a coincidence. The scientists with an eccentric idea of what science ought to be doing, not just ultimate particles, they were way beyond thinking about atoms, but particles capable of running machines or engines that are so small that to this point they're simply inconceivable to most people, but engines that are capable of controlling blood pressure, of monitoring neurological activity in the body, of being coupled with larger machines to treat tumors, and so on. That partnership began. The fact that engineering had the scale of laboratory necessary in the late 70s and early 80s for the work that the Wilsdorfs and John Matthews and others were doing was part of the story. But also, very frankly, part of the story was that we did not have the vision of a unified science enterprise here that would have made, as is the case at, say, Chapel Hill, or as is the case at Yale, would have made the medical school a natural partner of the traditional science departments in the college and the graduate school. What would have happened if the alliance between engineering and medicine had not occurred? Probably would have dropped behind another 4 or 5 years in terms of what it takes to catch up with competitors or peers in the sciences. What would have happened if we had realized the need for scale, both in science and in the sense of space and in the sense of the scale of faculty? Probably, if we got it, the college would have been another 10 years ahead of what it's going to take to bring the college up to being directly competitive in the sciences for our most powerful competitors. If you don't know the Stanford campus or don't know the Yale campus, take some time and look around. It's an intimidating experience because I see physical evidence, buildings, to show that at some point a generation ago, somebody doing something like what I've done for the last quarter century here in the Connecticut got it, and having got it, found resources to make it happen. But in any event, it becomes a defining element of our culture. Why the slow progress in the fine and performing arts? Let me go back to the story of the psychotherapist who comes over to explain girls to us. There was a conception that the fine and performing arts were the territory of girls, and that we were tough. We were the University of Virginia. And we would deal in theoretical and historical terms rather than developing the kind of strength that you find if you go to the new studio art building and walk around and look at what's going on in the studios that look a lot like science letters, as you know. Studios that are capable of supporting artwork and media that nobody was thinking about a generation ago. I should make a couple of observations about that building because it has a little bit to do with my conception of what it would take to solve this issue. I first saw a building that worked like that at Wellesley College. Wellesley College is all women. I saw women in the back court of that building with welding guns, building welded sculpture objects. And any notion that one might have had, the fine and performing arts were something like drawing with crayons or learning how to paint flowers. Flowers can be pretty interesting, learning how to paint flowers. Or on the other side, that women could not deal with the new media is blown all apart. If you go to Mount Holyoke or Wellesley or one of the other traditional women's colleges and look at why it is that their graduates are so often cited as the most important young artists in the country. It has to do with the kinds of physical experiences that they have under the instruction of faculty members who believe that their students can do anything. We realized early on after I came here that one thing that was critical was to build respect for students. That while the faculty was not scornful of students, they didn't lack respect for students. All of us together, in a sense, believe that what we see of students is the whole university. And the truth is, as you know, that we are segmented, that every classroom is its own little culture, but it's very difficult for anyone to assay the whole thing, to pick it up, to measure it, to decide what it all amounts to. And yet what it amounts to is a spectacular assemblage of young people who have come to learn. And their capacities, as you know, are equal to essentially anyone in the country. There is not a standard deviation spread in any of the standard indicators of preparedness to learn at the point of entry in this institution. Looking at fragments of a standard deviation and try to figure out who gets the stronger class. So I think in the case of the fine and performing arts, a kind of bias, a built-in institutional cultural bias is one of the reasons. I think also that just as expense was a probable barrier to developing serious science in the 60s and 70s, probably also there were some expense issues involved with the arts. How else was one explaining the Godzilla Laker method of locating studios that we had for art? At the time when we finally decided that it had gone far enough, we decided to build that building and die, we had 4 different designated studios. state-of-the-art facilities around the grounds. One was a former rock chipping laboratory for the geology department. One was a cluster of trailers. I think one somewhere was a house we acquired. But in any event, we did not have a unified approach to what it took to be the first rate art department. And we talked a lot about how bad it was that our state art department hadn't developed as rapidly as others had, not realizing that you've got to make the core commitment to the buildings if you expect faculty members to perform with their students. As the arts grow, watch what happens. We will announce in the fall, in fact, about the groundbreaking in the fall, the beginning construction for a building for a department that doesn't yet exist. The dance department is coming about because of student demand. That leads to another observation. It's simply that student demand drives university curriculum. That if one wants to see science, one demands it. If one wants to see art, one demands it. Now, universities have mechanisms to fill up their classrooms. When I was a student, we still had a rule that you had to apply for a major. And if you could not get accepted by a department, there was a competitive process of getting into the department. If you couldn't get accepted by the department you wanted to go to, ultimately you would have had to leave. And what actually happened is that people majored in a topic called rural social economics was farm management. We didn't have an ag school. We didn't really teach farm management. We taught rural social economics. And we had one faculty member. And the poor guy had a teaching load of 300 or 400 students. Because that was where you went if you couldn't get into another major. It's a theoretical department in the extreme. But in any event, that type of control mechanism is gone. And departments turn down students only because they lack space, not because the students don't measure up academically. And so you've got a different thesis about how to deal with space needs. I should say that if the state of Virginia or if the feds decide to get serious about funding subjects that will be used in economic development or economic recovery, the money is going to go to engineering and the sciences. That's simply the way it's going to happen. And for that to be beneficial to the university, we're going to have to have students who prepare their major in those subjects. And then the question becomes, how do you create a catchment for such students? My deans, our provosts, are going to have to deal with that issue fairly quickly if the next round after stimulus is a targeted investment in facilities to build strength in areas where we are weak as a nation and where other nations are strong. One has only to visit Italy or to visit China to see how effective and targeted national policy with regard to what universities do can be in building prosperity. Both of those nations badly crippled after World War II. Both of them increasingly moving toward prosperity, and in the case of Italy, I suspect probably it's done. The Italian standard of living is very close to being ours. When I was a student, to Italy as tourists, we always thought how sad the Italians were so poor. The Italians were also so smart, and what they did was go to school. And as a result of that, Mercedes now buys its diesel engines from the Italians. So we've gone way beyond the way things were 25 years ago. So we've got this history, the boys' school history. We've got disciplines that in different ways are heavily dependent on facilities. And we've got the need to grow the university. What happens? At some points in our history, programs such as the National Defense Education Act of the late 50s and early 60s, John Kennedy Education Act, produces the impetus to build strength. Is that going to happen now? I kind of doubt it. The federal government in the 60s and 70s, the same government that told students, if you will study the subjects that are important, sciences, engineering, if you prepare yourselves to build a stronger nation, we'll pay for it. Is now saying, if you'll go to college and borrow, we'll lend it to you. That's where federal education policy is going. There is no longer a federal program. If it comes about, it'll be a successor to the stimulus program. The best they can do is some threatening letters saying that if you don't lend enough and your students don't borrow, borrow them if you're in trouble. Program of Access CBA has made that largely irrelevant to us. And in consequence, I'm watching what will initially be a standoff of some sort between us and Princeton's and other schools and the feds over the fact that our students don't borrow enough to satisfy what the policy says they should do. The restructuring legislation of 2005-2006, private philanthropy, success in maintaining bond ratings that let us borrow at reasonable prices, AAA bond ratings. All of these together are parts of the solution. Donors, philanthropic donors, do not give science buildings to anybody. I can raise money for a building for the fine arts. Our humans and I together can raise money for the South Lawn Project, can raise money for the libraries, can raise money for engineering and so on, but when it comes to raising money for the sciences, much more complicated proposition. Donors have a hard time picturing a building the size of a city block and six stories tall as the place where they want to see their names displayed. And in our time, buildings are named because of donor involvement. The restructuring matters because the new buildings that are under construction were possible owing to a provision in that legislation that allows us to bond our own construction. That is, we sell bonds, pledging various kinds of revenues that are predictable and sustainable, but bonds that are rated AAA. And those bonds let us construct buildings of that kind. And in the case of the engineering building, we also have a major donor. Engineering is a different philanthropic world from what you have in other disciplines where there's science. These buildings were intended to be aggressive steps. But remember, if you will, what I said about the fact that if we'd taken the aggressive steps a generation ago, we would be in a very different situation. In my view, just as three key things to know about university goals in the next generation are China, China, and China, the three key things to know about the development of curricula are some kind of combination of science and the arts, science and the arts, science and the arts. That is, those are the places where we can achieve the advances as an institution that will make us interesting to the next generation of students and will make the university important, consequently. Let me move very quickly to this dilemma about innovation and tradition. Traditions, as you know, are basically the definition points of a culture. They're not everything there is in a culture, but they're definition points. The discussion of tradition and innovation largely has to do with the sciences, although it also has to do with the arts. All of us have gone through hearing someone say, that's clearly not art, I don't know what it's supposed to be. And I can remember this wonderful debate over the Calder sculpture placed on the grounds with a kind of benign but probably inexperienced and uninformed opposition to the notion that Calder could be displayed alongside Jefferson. I think it's worth observing that in this case, one of the few cases, Jefferson is larger than the one you saw, and that Calder's tiny piece of sculpture called a stabium. His small stabium has really changed the whole taste of the public art in the university. People now believe, as they should, I think, that we ought to be full of artworks, that the university ought constantly to be teaching students, faculty, the public, what art is about in our culture by making it central to the community. The discussion of tradition and change, however, doesn't start with the scientists or with the fine arts. Oddly enough, it started back in the 20s with an argument about poetry. I first heard the argument from a man named Sir John Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering that electrical and chemical forces are both elements in the operation of a neuron or a brain. When he published his papers, the idea was thought to be absurd because the body had no batteries. So how could there be an electrical activity going on in a nerve? Eccles came here when I was a student with an invitation to talk about the effects of his demonstration that it was electrochemical. By the way, you can see it in our own curriculum. A department of neuroscience was inconceivable before Eccles won the Nobel Prize. We've got whole chunks of the curriculum. The link in psychology and all of the sciences, of psychology and mathematics, that are derived from one person's demonstration that he could measure a charge on brain tissue as the body and the brain went through certain experiences. But when Eccles came to lecture, he lectured over in the South Meeting Room, and his lecture was actually about T.S. Eliot, and in particular about an essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent. The argument in the essay is hard, not because it's difficult to read, but because it is hard to grasp and lecture. What Eliot said is that traditions exist, but that any newly made thing that achieves the status of art, or by implication of science, of discovery, changes everything in the tradition. That is, that one can write or discover something in one era, and something 200 or 300 years later will be entered into the tradition and will change it. So that there is no such thing as a permanent value on any cultural artifact, or anything known by way of empirical science, or anything invented by an artist or by a poet. And then Eliot, after making that argument, proceeds to prove it, which is to say, you read Chaucer, if you know Shakespeare, with an awareness of what Shakespeare did to Chaucer. You read Waiting for Godot, if you know Shakespeare, with an awareness of what any number of modern authors have done to Shakespeare. And frankly, you read any given week's poems in, say, the New Yorker, or any given month's articles in, say, the scientific journal Nature, with a constant awareness of what they are doing to everything that came before. So a tradition is a living thing, and it's perpetually subject to change. It's not that science that was articulated and discovered before the calculus is wrong. It's that it is different because of the calculus. It's not that science calculated on a slide rule is wrong because of the computer. But it's different because of the computer. Because instead of carrying out an equation to one or two decimal points, you can carry it out to an infinite number of decimal points if the computer has large enough memory. And so each change in the tradition, each new thing added to it, changes everything that came before. In that context, within a university, even one that prides itself on its traditions, even one founded by someone who imagined a kind of university that didn't exist before, and forced that university on a state that didn't want it, and found a means to pay for it for the benefit of the daughters now and the sons then, of people who didn't know they needed it and weren't going to pay for it. All of that put together, you have the phenomenon that in this place that stood for revolution, that stood for change, over time, we have come to see our culture, and from time to time, outside observers see our culture also, as being one that is extremely traditional. And by traditional, we mean change resistant, right? Now, look around the room, and let me tell you some difference between the crowd you see here and the crowd I saw when I was new to this hall. You see women. You see dark skin. You see students of every, just glancing around the room, my guess is that basically every racial group within the university, in some sense, is represented. You will also see students from a far broader range of national and local origins. Students who come from elsewhere, who bring other experiences to the place. In a sense, you stand for tradition. You know, this is Jefferson Hall. But you wouldn't exist in the culture that exists now if you were not the multifaceted organization that brings you together for these weekly debates. The tradition has changed in such a way that the so-called old hall is dead. It may have died the day the first black student walked in the door and said, "I'm a probationer." His name was Wes Harris. It may have died the day the first woman came in and made the same notes. I've lost her name, she was a PhD candidate in history.
Barbara Lynn. Barbara Lynn.
Might be right.
Take pictures back there, we think. You've been told it's straight.
I'm not sure if the first one actually came on. innovation doesn't really compete with tradition. It doesn't necessarily keep all of it alive either, because just as a newly created thing can change the tradition, or does change it if it's a masterwork. That's a simpler way to put it. The masterworks of science and art fit in the same way in Eliot's analysis. Sometimes the newly created thing kills the old, the predecessor object, proves that it is wrong. The world was more or less flat until Copernicus more or less proved that it wasn't. It wasn't a matter simply of saying we will put a little adaptation on geography. It was we're going to throw the old geography out and have a new one. So there are ways in which that kind of change can even kill off the tradition. I think it's enough for this audience to say simply that Jefferson would not have wanted his university to be a place known for tradition, that he would have wanted it to be known as a place known for innovation, for change. As an old man, he became ever more reactionary in his politics. There's a wonderful letter that he wrote late in his life where he says that he really would not want to be a citizen of a republic whose people did not overthrow the government by violence about every 20 years. He argues simply that popular uprisings are the stuff of republics. Now, if you want to forgive him, you do it by saying that the next revolution after the one he was involved in leading was the French Revolution, which Jefferson watched with a kind of fascination in street theater. His descriptions of what it was to be in Paris in 1789 are worth digging out, because he did not see it as the death throes of a nation. He saw it as what Yeats would later on describe as this magnificent thing coming up out of chaos in that poem called Slouching Toward Bethlehem. This new thing, Slouching Toward Bethlehem to be born, is Yeats' symbol for modernity or change. The new thing is Christ in the poem. So we have this phenomenon that in our culture we've got sort of a conflict. We take pride in knowing our tradition. For what it's worth, so eventually will our community colleges, so does Oxford, so does the idea of owning university in Poland. You go through the whole list of great institutions and give them enough time to begin to preserve their traditions. That's simply the way institutions work. How does one protect innovation in the context? In a sense, one does it by knowing where to fight. One, for example, opposes curricula that are so bound up in values of prior times that they limit, discourage, or prohibit experiential learning. I'm fascinated that Duke has announced as one of its university purposes over the next 5 years to have 90% of its undergraduates study outside the U.S., but to do it by two-way digital communications, and that the interface they're using was developed by a company named Kaplan that belongs to the Washington Post and is being sold as what's called white package software to about 15 of the top 25 universities, not including us. We ought to be one of Kaplan's customers. We ought to be buying and using that software to enable students to be mobile, enable faculty members to teach in ways that are simply not possible. Kaplan software will let the faculty member teaching a course know when students have not gotten a point, and even know down to a specific student who missed something that's going to hurt that student on an exam in 6 weeks. Therefore, intercepting the problem and solving the problem becomes simply a function of the software, because the information is right there. The software at its best, and the best in the world is at the Duke NUS Graduate School of Medicine in Singapore, at its best will back a student up right in the middle of a lecture and tell the student to redo something, or take the student off to the side and remind the student of something learned, say, in undergraduate biochemistry, and apply it back to what's being taught in the classroom. And one of the Duke NUS claims to fame is that it doesn't require students to attend classes. They can take their laptops and go to coffee shops. They can sit at their laptops in their bathrobes, beside their beds in their bedrooms. They can do whatever they wish, so long as every day at the end of the class, they've been able to demonstrate that they got it. It's a software that doesn't let you fail. It makes you succeed in the material. That is a kind of instruction. It's a mode of reinforcement that no traditional university needs. And it's a case of innovation that's rapidly making a difference between the also-rans and the frontier. Software that does something that human beings by themselves can't do. Even as we fight curriculum teaching practices that constrain innovation, we also have got to be increasingly sensitive to the fact that building buildings for purposes that are too narrow is very struggling. The wonderful Brooks Museum down the pathway here, in addition to all of its other problems, was built for the sole purpose of displaying Jefferson's mammoth on wires. And so every academic program that's ever gone into the building had to make do with something that was not in the design of the building. Fairweather Gymnasium, where the art history department is across the street, was built to be a gymnasium. It was supposed to be a front-runner facility. Its great claim to fame was that it had the first basketball court for intercollegiate basketball. All they messed up on was the NCAA's dimensions for basketball. Consequently, the building ceased to be a basketball court after the first season, and I went to work on Young Gym. And over time, it became increasingly a cast-off and unwanted building. That's how art got it. So art history and studio art both wound up in the building. Then in the 90s, as we got to looking at the building, we realized that it was never going to be a gymnasium, that it was never going to be an effective academic building if it stayed the way it was, but that everyone agreed that its exterior was attractive, and if the roof had not been screwed up in some sort of economy campaign at some point, it would have been a beautiful building. The monitor, the light structure that's on the roof, was added in the rehab of the building. We gutted the building. We tried to salvage all the interior walls. It wasn't working. So the building was taken right down to bare masonry. We gutted the building and built a new building inside the old building. You can preserve the tradition, but to do it, in a sense, you spend money, because what you do is construct the space for the modern use, the space for the one that matters now. Purpose-built, as the Brits would say, or bespoke, as they would say. You build it within the historic structure of the old. We've been very limited in allowing access to our programs for outsiders. And ironically, among the outsiders are older people who might want to take our courses. You know that it's only about 1 year beyond when the first group of you entered as first-year students. We have only part-time undergraduate students of all, except those who didn't prove they had money. But the part-time adult students, the BIS students, who you will see in your classes from time to time, or if you're lucky, you may get into one of their classes, because sometimes they will take undergraduates and go into their courses. Those are a very new phenomenon. We've learned something about excluding people. It's a lesson not unlike, by the way, excluding by sex or excluding by race. It has to do with the reality of excluding by age, but it's every bit as bad an idea if what you intend to be is a vital university. And I guess finally, deans in particular constantly struggle with promotion and tenure criteria that may discourage innovation among the youngest, newest, most innovative, most creative, least conventional faculty members. Just as new students are inevitably a kind of challenging population for a university to run, so are new faculty members. I hope you don't see that, but I can remember when I began my first job, which was at the University of California in 1970, the discovery that I was the only guy in the place who didn't have long hair, so I thought I needed that. I tried. I was lacking some of the foundation elements of long hair. So I got it down to sort of where my ears are at one point. Felt pretty good about it. I went to work on a beard, and I didn't know you had to trim a beard, so my beard became rabbinical fairly quickly. I looked sort of like Santa Claus with a dark beard. Then, over time, my hair began to get lighter and lighter and lighter and whatnot, and thinner and necessary to what I was there to do. And over time, I began to, in a sense, to see my colleagues in a very different way from simply trying to look like them. I was given by a woman who taught me when I was an undergraduate a copy of a letter of recommendation she had sent to California, Berkeley, when I went there. But she said simply she wanted to apologize for it. And the letter was a glowing letter, except that in the last sentence she said, "Bear in mind, when I was a student, we were dressed like this, notwithstanding the dirty shirts and so on. People at Berkeley weren't. And I went there in 1970. In the last line, she said, "The only criticism I would have is that he generally is not as well dressed as he should be." How do you remove the barriers to innovation? A number of things. Encourage experiential learning. That's where the academy or the curriculum learns what's necessary to be taught in the classroom in the next decade or the next year. Encourage students to be out in the community. Learn the lesson of Duke and US. Learn the lesson that Duke has learned at Durham. And realize the importance of letting people live in the real world as part of their academic experience. Build the partnerships. One type is, in a sense, a faculty issue, but build partnerships with corporate partners, build partnerships with government, build partnerships with community action organizations, rather than seeing them as destructive elements who might tear apart traditions. Maybe see them as the seedbeds of change that might remake traditions, that might do what Eliot says any new masterwork does in the larger fabric of a tradition. Recognize faculty members who regularly challenge the boundaries. I have a favorite story of a faculty member doing this, and I told some of you the story, but this telling of it has a slightly different purpose. I had an appointment years ago with one of our deans, one of our department heads, for a given morning, for the purpose of discussing their belief that a faculty member was too old to continue. And the discussion was to be about the desire that I would find her incompetent to continue. It happened that I had met her at cocktail parties and had been fascinated by the fact that she was teaching religion and physics and engineering, and she didn't see any conflict among the three, and she felt that her religious studies courses were enriched by the fact that she was also working on the ultimate theories of magnetism, that she had a set of interests that went way beyond normal curriculum. The meeting never happened because that morning, the newspapers carried information that she was the oldest person ever elected to the National Academy of Sciences. And the department head, a friend of mine, called me early and said, "Have you seen the morning papers?" And I'm, "Yeah, I have seen it." And he said, "I guess we need that meeting." I said, "No, I don't think we do." A university has to be able to tolerate the fact that individual talent doesn't follow set rails toward the future. But individual talent manifests itself in the form of deviation from a standard. The individual talent changes the tradition because it doesn't simply buy the tradition. It constantly challenges the curriculum. As Shakespeare looked at Chaucer and said, "Well, that's good enough, I won't write anything." The progress of history would have been changed in very dramatic ways. If one comes from the South and wants to be a writer and is intimidated by William Faulkner, that's beside the point. William Faulkner was not intimidated by the literary traditions he set out to overthrow. And if one is Sir John Eccles in a laboratory at Oxford and discovers that he can put an electrical charge into a nerve fiber and make the brain do something, and says, "That's got to be wrong, we didn't learn that in graduate school," one doesn't win the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Science doesn't develop. The course of scientific history is changed in terrible ways. Where does the responsibility to tolerate aberrant students lie? Lionel Trilling wrote a short story when he was teaching writing at Columbia about an eccentric student and about the difficulty he faced as a faculty member in taking this guy seriously because the guy didn't look like him. Because the guy didn't talk like him, because he clearly didn't think like him. And Trilling basically tells the story of Trilling, the faculty, losing the struggle of the student, because the creative impulse that was in this guy was simply more powerful than the negative, the constraints that the faculty members have constructed. Who deals with that? Individual faculty members, department chairs, groups of faculty members, students talking to faculty members, preferably in groups. But then there's the matter of the faculty. What protects the eccentric who sees religion and physics? What allows the eccentric to continue the work that brings the prize, the recognition, and changes the tradition in the dramatic ways that those prizes do? Or to go to a different field in time, what protects a Nelson Mandela? What permits a Gandhi to exist? This morning's newspaper showed Gandhi's daughter placing the remaining portion of Gandhi's ashes in the water off South Africa. Why? That's where Gandhi had to go to find a refuge when British colonialism, imperialism closed India to him. When London itself was closed, he'd gone to London to be educated. He went to South Africa to practice law. He wasn't able to go back to India. He went back to India when his realization that he had to overthrow the tradition became more powerful than his desire to do. And after something like 35 years, he took on the tradition. You could argue that a benevolent God oversaw Gandhi's development and prepared him to go back and spur the revolution. But it's a sort of a self-protective argument, because the bottom line is that, rather like St. Paul, he found himself at a certain point, there's no place to hide. And he had to go back to it. So he had the fact that even the genius sometimes has to go a route as a company. We've got some examples, by the way, of enormous innovative programs that we have not fed and have not understood for what they are. We have a world-class program that studies the science of estuaries. What's that all about? Estuaries, as you know, are both the nurseries and the cleaning structures for bays and oceans. We have the science. We haven't realized that the science has policy implications. And the policy implications change the way laws are made. They change the way federal money is spent. They change the obligations of the state. And it's left to individual citizen activists to file the lawsuits that are changing environmental policy. It's not being done by universities anyway. The activism is passed over. The people are simply furious because the water they remember is pure green or pure blue or pure white is now something else entirely. So the absence of a school of environmental science or environmental policy, I'm sorry, is a sign of a challenge to the tradition we have not yet assimilated. We have a partnership with the Coulter Foundation for what's called translational research. It's an attempt to bring biomedical engineers, traditional scientists, including those at the college and graduate school, medical practitioners, business people, and so on, into a conspiracy to test and convert new technologies rapidly so that patients do not suffer, so that mass public health catastrophes do not occur. One way to understand the conditions in Haiti tonight is to understand that we have not developed a science to deal with the scale and the predictability of the problem that's down there. If you hear or read that they should have known better than to build their houses without reinforcing rods in their walls, walk away. They didn't have the means either to know about reinforcing rods or to use them. There's a flaw in the economic system that failed, if it's possible to say, to address a quake of quite that scale. It's conceivable that no structure could withstand that quake. But then the medical issues, the complaints about sanitation. People who live in concentration camps don't voluntarily live in filth. They don't voluntarily avoid baths. They don't voluntarily drink water that has bacterial matter in it. People who live in barrios, lived in intensely concentrated cities of Asia, and emphatically people who live tonight in Port-au-Prince. not just Haiti's problem. We don't see what happened in those tremendous tsunamis that occurred in the Bay of Bengal 2 to 5 years ago. It's not as close as Haiti was. We're not confronting the fundamental ethnic hatreds that make solutions in Haiti so difficult. And I've noticed that even the New York Times, which is generally pretty straight in telling the story, has failed to mention that the great anomaly is that Haiti is the only French-speaking nation in the Caribbean. That it has an ethnically different origin from its neighbors. If you want to know why Haitians are not welcome as temporary workers in Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States, look into the ethnicity and wonder what universities might have done to teach us through that kind of finally, very quickly, the transition from a local or regional focus, a parochial focus, to a global focus. Jefferson had two large goals aside from his individual goals for his university. The individual goal was cut and dry, to make people free. On the other hand, he wasn't thinking about women. He was not thinking about black people, even black people living in Monticello with him. He wasn't imagining his universities extending beyond the social class that was then. On one side, you might say the ruling class. On the other side, you might say the more responsible class. I don't really care how you cut that. But that was as far as the vision went. It had two other purposes. One was to compel us as a people to look outward from our continent. He was afraid that Americans living on the edges, remember this is the turn of the 19th century, living on the edges of our vast, endlessly wealthy continent, would simply look inward toward our own wealth and not realize that we are part of a larger nation, that we belong as surely to Asia or to Europe or Africa as we do to Kansas or to West Virginia or North Carolina. And that purpose was part of what drove it. The other purpose was to drive our government toward finding some way to do business other than simply engaging constantly in warfare. He was urged once during his tenure as president to take an interest in a foreign war. It was the Greek War for Independence. War is a complicated piece of history. We'll talk about it. It's not as clean as the War for Independence. Whether Jefferson thought about that or not, I don't know. But it's in that set of conversations that he said that his notion of a good foreign policy was to avoid entanglements that would lead to armed conflicts. And he's followed by his protege, Madison, who goes exactly the other way and sends high technology, America's fast frigates, the secret weapons of that period, to North Africa to take out the Barbary pirates, which they do with a kind of clinical precision. It's probably the last American intervention that actually went according to plan. Go in, do it, get out. There are reasons for that, too. You can't carry so much hard tack and water. You got to get home. But in any event, the policies changed very quickly. But Jefferson was very fearful that we would become so enmeshed in political intrigues that we would miss the reality that he was trying to create what he called in one place an empire for liberty and its coming, and not simply an empire for the purpose of empire. I think we know that in the 19th century and the 20th century, we developed enormous stature as an institution because of the quality of our core undergraduate programs, the college in particular, the development of the McIntyre School toward the end of the century, the extraordinary strengths in the school of architecture. Those things are givens. They are, in a sense, what the world sees when it looks toward us. Also, the superb professional schools, the Law School, the Garden School, increasingly the School of Medicine. But we think of those developments quite often as individual and local developments. What I want to wind up with is simply the argument that the competition for talent now, whether it's student talent or faculty talent, the competition for ideas, whether it's the ideas behind the Duke and U.S. Graduate School of Medicine in Singapore, or the ideas behind the latest thing that's done in Westinghouse Laboratories, but the competition for ideas. And indeed, the scientific interaction makes for change. Our JLab is tightly involved with the facility in Switzerland that is now the largest superconductor. the Australians finish bridging the outback with theirs, we will be involved with them. Because physicists, above all, realize that no one can own a machine. Astronomers figured this out a long time ago, because no one can own enough telescopes to get everything they must know to be effective in that field. But physicists know it also. We have to learn it in every discipline across the board. And we have to be prepared to stand the test of global, of international scrutiny, and of winning the approval of colleagues who are not of our culture, but of other cultures entirely, if we're going to test our mettle, test our capacity to compete and to win. And the winning has to do in large part with what our students experience in this world. Study abroad. We went from about 8% of our students studying abroad to a prediction this year that if the trends that are anticipated for this class that will graduate this spring hold, about 35% of our graduates will study abroad. That took about 15 years. What's it good for? It's simply good for teaching people how to understand the world that they intend to take on as graduates. If you talk to the deans or the language department heads, by the way, but the demand for language is fascinating, things turn up. And our top five languages now are both, that is the five most demanded, are both Mandarin and Arabic. And the demand for Arabic surged right after 9/11. When I was a student in the Vietnam War began, we did not sign up for Vietnamese. And I can promise you that we did not do what some of you may have done, but I mean that several hundred of our students did. We didn't sign up for the Army either. We did everything we could to avoid having to deal face on with that conflict. Students in this era are quite different. The global facing character that Jefferson imagined as being the product of education is your property. It belongs to your generation. It's a source of strength for the future. The coming of international students. Tremendous increases in the number. When I became president, we had a little over 500. As of graduation this year, we'll have a little over 2,000. So there's the change there. What does that mean to you? If you're an international student, it means you're here. Good. If you're not, it means that inevitably you have shared classrooms with international students. You've learned something about the cultures in which other people grew up. You may have discovered reasons to respect other people other than restaurants that serve the food they may have known growing up, or automobiles that represent the industrial capacity of the nation. Respecting other people for the quality of the discourse, for the quality of the argument, the capacity to carry on the argument that makes for change. That may be the best possible product of this ongoing process of sharing students' information. U21, which some of you will know because of the summer programs for students doing research and that sort of thing, has been an enormous asset to us as we work through that part of what we're on. I looked at the start of the semester and we had about 700 faculty members involved in some of the U21 activities. U21 students and faculty come here. In the summertime, in a typical year, we'll have a graduate student group working across the disciplines, sharing the results of their research, and contributing to research journals that carry their work. The same thing happens at about the second or third year with undergraduate students, sometimes in general, sometimes in engineering only, sometimes in business. What it means to study business in the European Union, by the way, is not what it means to study business in the US. And what it means to study business in Mumbai, in Singapore, in Tokyo, is not what it means to study business here or in Philadelphia or in Chicago. The disciplines themselves reflect the national cultures, the national economies in which they function. But if you graduate from here believing that you have competence to pursue business, and if you perceive the world to be in your field of competition and do not have that kind of education as to business and that kind of command of languages, it's going to be tough. So the purpose is more than simply a purpose that's large and institutional. It's a very personal matter. First time in my life, about 3 years ago, a student came to me and said, the language requirements here are not tough enough. And I said, really? Yeah, I said, I've had 3 years of something and I've forgotten what it is and I can't speak the language. And I said, well, what can you do? I said, I can make C's, but I can't speak what I'm really scared of, I think I should be able to read a contract in that language and conduct a business transaction. I received a contract the other day that originated in the University of Switzerland. I took my last German course in about 1969. I taught my last German course in 1975. I think I know German. However, reading the contract, I realized that there was a verb in the ultimate line of the contract, the one that's the clincher, the one you better watch because if you're going to get ahead, that's where you're going to get it. It was a verb that made no sense to me. It was some kind of idiomatic use of the verb that I didn't receive. So we sent the document over to Gordon Stewart and asked Gordon, what's that verb? Now, the verb was used in such an arcane sense that Gordon had to do some research on it. So it's not an everyday use. Bottom line is that if we had not had access to people with Gordon, we could easily have entered into an agreement that would have had minor bad effect, but some bad effect on the university. And yet, our partner on the other side was not trying to trick us. Our partner was simply using the language that was used. The logicalist. The student who said, I'm not satisfied with my level of language competency is telling me something important. So is the contract officer who can't be exactly sure what a given verb means today in German as it is written and spoken in Switzerland. Interaction of migrations nowadays is international. It's not safe to believe, by the way, that contracts are always written in English. They aren't. What's even scarier is that many contracts are written in multiple languages. And if one is doing business in Shanghai, they're doing business in Zurich, they're doing business in South Africa, and has multiple contracts on the table and needs only the one in the language where one is safe. One is not carrying out one's fiduciary duty. Or to put it differently, one's risking losing whatever the interest is that one wants to protect. Languages, international competencies, and frankly, increasingly, more informed knowledge of how business works, business in the commercial sense, or business in the scientific sense, or government, how business is conducted in other countries. Those things have to be built into what we learn and teach in universities. I think the partnerships we've started are valuable. I think they say a lot about where the university has to be. The global perspective, as I see it, comes to us with our students. I think that a student going into a school that was as isolated and as contained within its safe perimeters as was the one to which I came in 1961 would immediately start screaming and on the extreme end probably walk out. So you come, in a sense, fortified against some of the institutional concerns. But now, on the other hand, in any institution, there is a process of learning a culture. And the process of learning the culture is the process of mastering the traditions. And the traditions are always the enemy of innovation. Keep somewhere in the back of your head two things. One, an old man on Monticello Mountain saying that he really wouldn't want to live in a country that did not overthrow its government by violence about once every 20 years. And the other, this is not my phrase, it belongs to Hunter Rawlings, who's teaching classics here every semester. China, China, China. Not so much because it's China, although that's the first point that Hunter's trying to make. But second, because it's out there, it's across the ocean. It's away from the area that most of us think about every morning. And it's the rest of the world that is essential to useful knowledge.